through what was left in their own minds. There was a time when a strong man was born, not to cut his hair, nor drink from the fruit of the vine, was shorn of his enemies, and was cast down in disgrace. It was a time when Levites, priests of the living God, kept concubines and spoke to rape, murder, and dismemberment. When everyone does what is right in their own eyes, the only one that comes naturally. And what comes naturally is not always what is best for humanity. Now, this is to say that everyone in Israel was a selfish relativist. Now, Hannah, Hannah's husband, is at the very least an outwardly pious man. He goes to Shiloh every year to fulfill his family duties, and there he receives his dues as a member of the clan of Levi. This is a fact that the text in 1 Samuel hides from us, as though ashamed of how far the Levite clan had fallen, the Hophni and Phinehas fleecing worshippers at the door. Yet even though he is a Levite, we are never really sure of whether Elkanah's religious piety is sincere. But at least he tries to love his family, including his barren wife. Now, as you may know, barrenness shows up everywhere in the Bible. We may be aware of some of the more prominent barren women, like Sarah or Rachel. The land itself is said to be rendered barren upon Israel's disobedience to their covenant with Yahweh. Barrenness, far from being something that can be fixed by in vitro fertilization of the womb or chemical fertilization of the land, was a sign of the tragedy that is the fallenness of the world. A sign of lifelessness. It was a sign of death. In the ancient Near East, a barren woman was a worthless woman. A woman whose dignity was stripped by a culture that viewed her as good and dead. Hannah, unfortunately, is not left alone to suffer quietly. Instead, every year, when she and the rest of her family make their way up to Shiloh, where the ark of the Lord is kept, Elkanah's other wife reminds Hannah of what a worthless woman she is. Year after year, we are told, Hannah endures Phinehas' torture. And year after year, Hannah becomes so upset that the feast becomes ashes in her mouth. Elkanah loves Hannah, but he's thick-headed and cannot understand Hannah's name. No, Elkanah, even though your name means Creator God, you are not enough for Hannah in her withering and her dying. Elkanah may love Hannah, but he does not see her, does not remember her, does not know her, and therefore is not better than ten sons. To describe how much being barren tore at Hannah's heart, it's worth looking deeper into the Hebrew text. When Hannah weeps at the temple in Shiloh, it's not the quiet sniffle of a proper lady. Instead, what we read in English as Hannah's bitter weeping might be better translated as Hannah's weeping of weepings. Hers was the deepest groaning one can do for the Lord, whom she was sure did not see her and had forgotten her. We can almost imagine Hannah laying flat on the ground, her cheek pressed against the dusty floor, tears and mucus running down her face. She spreads herself out to pray. Even for an ancient culture, there was use to public displays of grief and tearing your clothes and donning sackcloth and ashes. This was shocking behavior. We may ask ourselves whether we can do as Hannah does. First, she disrupts her own life by not playing happy face with her husband. Next, she disrupts the family Christmas dinner in Shiloh by leaving abruptly. And now, she disrupts the quiet of the temple by publicly prostrating herself while crying out to God. And in the chorus act, by a woman already seen as worthless. But Hannah's response is the most faithful response she could possibly make. Hannah's response is the most faithful response she could have made. And in the places that we are barren in our own lives, to cry out relief from our barrenness is the most appropriate response to each of them. Many of us in our bland niceness are not being faithful to God and how we order our emotions. For Christ-likeness does not consist of perpetual hugs and smiles, nor does Christ-likeness consist in tears and sighs all the time. Even more, Christ-likeness is not in flat effort. No. Christ-likeness has always been in the right emotion for the right circumstance. And when you have suffered, as Hannah has suffered, the right response, the most faithful response, is to scream to God for vindication, for rescue. Elkanah is sincere, but stupid. Peninnah is fertile, but cruel. Hannah is there, but she pours herself out before God. And so is shown to be faithful in the midst of her barrenness. What sets the prayer of Hannah apart is not only her honesty in wanting to be finally seen and remembered by God, but how she promises that if her barrenness is cured, her child will take on the Nazarite vow as a sign of lifelong dedication to Yahweh. Hannah's gain, her blessing, will immediately become God's blessing to others, and not just for herself. It's a microcosm of how the blessing of God on Israel was never just for Israel itself, but for the world that God loves for us. It is here, while Hannah is sprawled on the ground, crying in the weeping of weepings, that she looks for God to see her, to remember her. And in that seeing and remembering, for God to do something new. Yet Hannah still lives in a blind world, one that cannot see her as anything but a useless, worthless, barren woman. Eli, the priest of the door, assumes Hannah has had too much to drink. Eli only sees a drunken woman, a common occurrence during those feast days. And she says, no, my Lord. Do not discount me as just another daughter of worthlessness. Even though the world does not see or know Hannah for her real worth, she clings to the hope that God still does. She holds out for God to see her, to remember her, and she takes steps forward in faithful prayer for God to act in His character, according to His character, and prove that He does see her and has never forgotten her at all. You know, the worst part of suffering is believing that we only suffer in silence, in isolation, and in hiddenness, that no one sees it, that no one understands our tears and our rage, that all of these things mean nothing. So we form support groups, hoping that by sharing experiences with others, that we might be seen in our agony, and so be able to find solidarity in our affliction. But somehow, for those of us who know and have been a part of support groups, somehow being heard by others is never enough. Not enough. For as much as sharing our pain with the community might be helpful, it does not eliminate the trauma of life in a broken world. What we all want, when we are in the midst of grief, is to be seen. It helps when others can bear witness to our pain. But there is only so much that friends and confidants can do for us as we twist and turn in the grip of something awful. And it is as we twist and turn that we hope for deliverance, for our pain to cease. Something that no friend, no matter how wise or well-connected, can ever do for us. Whether we realize it or not, what we want is for God to bear witness to our pain, to see us in our suffering, to remember us as we are turned inside out. We often forget that Jesus was not crucified alone, but that two other criminals were executed next to him, one on our side. And in his suffering, one of the criminals asks, what we all want to ask of Jesus when we are in pain, when we are dying away. He asks, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. I can almost imagine what Jesus would have said, how it would have looked when he did it, turning his blood-smeared face toward the criminal. Maybe he even smiles a little, even though he's dying too. What is he saying? He says, today, you will be with me in paradise. Today. Not tomorrow. Not in 10 years. Not when we're older and wiser and have perspective on things. Today, I see you. Today, I remember you. Today, you will be with me in paradise. And this, more than anything else, is what I want to hear from Jesus this myself. Today, you will be with me. Yet while we wait for relief, we often, and I often, do not suffer well. Most of us simply want pain to stop, so we can carry on pain-free living. Yeah, shut us out of life. Yet this is where the virtue of Hannah shines through. She doesn't pray for a child so she can rub it in his face or curry more favor of Hannah. She doesn't pray for a child, but that she can feel normal about her son. Or have a son so who can take care of her when she gets old. She prays for a child, for a son, who will not be for her, but for God. More importantly, Hannah's vision for her son is not simply vindication for her feelings of worthlessness, but for God to do a new thing in a time when corrupt priests stood at the door of the temple. And everyone did what was right in their own eyes. The text tells us that God sees and remembers Hannah. But the truth is, he had never ceased watching over her. He had never forgotten her. And this is what Hannah felt. And what we feel. Desperate. Unseen. Unknown. Yet God sees. God remembers. And by making fruitful what once was there, God does a new thing. In time, Hannah has a boy. And when she finally brings the boy to Shiloh, she sings this song. And then Hannah prayed aloud and said, "My heart rejoiced in the Lord. The Lord, my horn is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies. For I delight in your deliverance. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. Do not keep talking so proudly, or let your mouth speak such arrogance. The Lord is a God who knows. And by him deeds are made. The bows of the warriors are broken, but those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who were full hired themselves out for food, but those who were hungry are hungry no more. She who was barren has borne 7 children, a perfect number. But she who has had many sons hides away. The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them as princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. For the foundations of the earth are not the Lord's, so are the Lord's. On them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful servants, but the wicked will be silenced in the place of darkness. It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord are broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven. The Lord will judge the end of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. This is where many of us who suffer want to be. Singing of the goodness of God. Singing in our vindication for having trusted Him. Singing for our joy that is complete. The feeling of God's absence clings to us like a stench of a morgue. We, like Hannah, cry out for deliverance, for vindication. But in the silence, we are afraid that God has forgotten us, that God does not watch over us. It is here, in that silence, and as heart-wrenching as it can be, that we must choose to remember God ourselves. To throw ourselves down before Him and see and remember Him for ourselves. To remember that His eye is on the sparrow, the smallest, most insignificant of things. and thus his honor is on me. What little strength I have today, I ask this, that my barrenness not be removed from my comfort or present enjoyment, but for the sake of some ongoing redemption that I cannot yet see. Let my suffering be meaningful. Let my pain be redeemed. See me, Lord. Remember me, Lord. Heal my barrenness. And through it, do a new thing. Ourselves and how can do. As hard as it is, Lord, help us to choose. Help us to choose to see you first. To see you and remember you. And Lord, don't forget us. See us. Remember us. See us when we deal with people who torture us. See us as we deal with the circumstances that fill us. See us as we deal with our barrenness. Remember us. Not so that we can be comforted for ourselves, and so that we too can see your redemption in our lives. And so give glory to you. Not to us, not to us, but to your name, Lord. Amen.